KPOO San Francisco 89.5. My name is Dr. Rafe Eric Biggs, and you're listening to Reality Sandwich. And on the show today, we have Daniel Pinchbeck and Stacey Haynes. So stay tuned. Welcome to Reality Sandwich. My name is Dr. Rafe Eric Biggs. And today's show, we have Daniel Pinchbeck as our first guest. Daniel Pinchbeck is the author of the best-selling book 2012, Return of Quetzalcoatl, and Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. He's the co-founder of Evolver, which publishes Reality Sandwich, the leading web magazine for transformative culture. Evolver.net, the network that supports the Evolver social movement. His feature articles have appeared in New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Wired, The Village Voice, Art Form, and many other publications. His focus of the new documentary 2012 Time for Change is premiering this weekend in San Francisco. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Excellent.
Recovering from jet lag. Happy to be here in San Francisco.
Oh, fantastic. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit more about your background and the interest of what the film is about this weekend?
I wrote a couple of books. The first book, Breaking Open the Head, was about psychedelic drugs and shamanism. And for that book, I went down to the Amazon and in West Africa and so on. And that book kind of led me to the second book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, which was about prophecies of the Hopi and the Maya and kind of trying to understand this time, that maybe these shamanic cultures that had a more psychic, psychic and intuitive level of awareness actually were able to access forms of understanding that our modern society had forfeited or lost. And so I also looked at a lot of Western thinkers like Carl Jung and Heidegger and Nietzsche and Rudolf Steiner, and different phenomena from ayahuasca, shamanism, and crop circles in England. And I ended up in that book kind of proposing that 2012, which is the end of the Mayan calendar, the end of a long count cycle of 5,100 years, might actually be significant as kind of the hinge point in a larger shift that we've gone through this, you know, very intensive development of modernity, rational thought, technology, and we kind of suppressed a lot of other parts of ourselves. And as we go through this shift, maybe there's going to be an integration of those parts that we suppressed. And this, you know, the book kind of led to João Amorim, a Brazilian director, contacting me and us doing this film together, where we kind of step off from the ideas in my book and look at it very practically, like what would this transformation kind of consist, you know, what would it be made of practically. And so, you know, we talk about shamanism, we have all sorts of interviews. We interview Sting about his work with ayahuasca, David Lynch about transcendental meditation, the actress Ellen Page about permaculture. But we kind of moved from the personal spiritual transformation to what could happen onto society at large. And so we look a lot at Buckminster Fuller's ideas about kind of a design science revolution and how that could be applied to kind of making a society that was more sustainable and resilient and equitable.
Daniel, it's Martin Matthews. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Thanks back. Thank you so much for coming back to Reality Sandwich. We are delighted to have you back on the air with us, especially since we are Reality Sandwich compatriots with you and your website.
Exactly.
Well, boy, it certainly sounds like, I mean, this is really about as, you know, a planetary-wide reality sandwich in that we're catching up with a lot of these ways that you had mentioned, a lot of systems and processes that we've created in place right now that aren't really working for us collectively as humanity. And, you know, that kind of thing showing up is a real need in many of us to realize, you know, hey, we've got to reconnect with you know, what's inherent and natural. And what I love about so much of your work is that, you know, we're creating a whole different framework, I think much more aligned with what the Mayans were really talking about with respect to what's happening in 2012, as opposed to the commercialized gloom and doom that is, you know, getting into the minds of people with regard to the meaning of this year.
Yeah, well, we interviewed a number of Mayans in the film. I mean, it's very complicated also because the contemporary indigenous Maya did not preserve the long count. They did preserve this doctrine of world ages from the Popol Vuh, that there are these kind of cycles of development and then often kind of like destruction, recreation. And there are definitely stern warnings, you know, from the contemporary Maya about, you know, the fact that we've kind of gone off course and, you know, have kind of disregarded nature and the environment and you know, kind of lost respect for the gods and so on. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of some stern warnings with these prophecies that we may see a lot of destruction, degeneration. But at the same time, I also really do believe that you know, something new can be born. It definitely seems like it's going to be you know, a race to the finish line in the next decade or so.
Right, right. And the film is called Time for Change. So. Clearly,
exactly.
a strong point on the opportunity side of things, as opposed to, you know, the world collapsing kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it seems, you know, very clear to, you know, the community of people that I'm working with that you know, the main thing is first of all just a consciousness shift that we don't have to do things as we've been doing them. That we're stuck in the inertia of all these systems, you know, systems that we've inherited. But, you know, we could, you know, redo agriculture, you know, from monoculture agriculture to permaculture. You know, we could change the monetary system so that it's not the only form of value is issued by, you know, privatized banking consortiums who, you know, create artificial scarcity, you know, through debt. et cetera, et cetera. You know, we could look at, you know, ways of creating alternative energy systems that aren't, you know, going to cause, you know, massive coastal flooding and so on.
Right. I want to ask you this. I mean, you've been such a deep observer of humanity and human behavior and the human condition. And when we talk about these things, you know, we could be doing this. We could create a system that worked for everyone. It seems that those notions resonate deeply within each of us. We all feel that and go, oh, yeah, right, of course. But, you know, but we don't. If only I could change, or if you could change. I mean, there's this something that's holding us back. What do you, you know, if you were to speak to the, you know, what's going on that's holding back humanity, that's holding back individuals, that's keeping us stuck in those, you know, old ways that aren't working and preventing us from, you know, taking action on this stuff that we're feeling that feels so good when you speak about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, like, you know, there's definitely, it's almost like taboos around, you know, kind of like, you know, manifesting at the level that one could in all these different areas. You know, I wrote that Marianne Williamson quote that we're, like, you know, afraid of how magnificent we could actually be or something. I think that there's an element of that. And then I also think that, you know, this stuff is a little bit more conceptually harder to grasp and harder to organize around. It's very easy, if you don't like something, to organize around it. Like, you don't like, you know, the war or the drilling. I mean, you know, so people will get together and oppose something. And we've learned now that only ends up, or often mainly ends up, feeding energy to the thing that you're opposing. I mean, if you do a big protest and the police will get to buy more tear gas and tasers, and the National Guard will get a bigger budget. You know, so it's harder to get people to rally, you know, for positive transformation. First, they really have to understand that it's possible, and then the communities have to be formed to kind of begin the practices, and then also kind of spread the information. I mean, that's what we're trying to do with Evolver. We've created these Evolver regionals, what we're kind of calling the Evolver social movement, incorporating a little of some of the ideas from this English movement called Transition Town, you know, and how do we kind of brand this positive transformation process that could take place.
Right, right. I mean, certainly we're seeing that within pockets of healing communities, amongst folks, you know, dealing with particular ailments. We're using the internet to connect with one another, share stories, what's working. People are tapping in and sharing ideas about how to be in pursuit of health from a much broader paradigm than what's being provided to them through the, you know, the quote medical system. And these communities are growing, and the organizations that serve them are growing, and loads of people are getting better. It's, you know, the more that we each collectively begin to look at what it is we want to create and put our energies there, the more I believe this time will move forward. So when, do you know the specifics on when and where, you know, the film is opening here in San Francisco this weekend?
Yeah, the film is opening, it's going to be playing 7 p.m. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at the Landmark Lumiere Theater. I don't actually know the address off the top of my head, but I assume it could be looked up on the internet.
I believe that's done by the Embarcadero.
Oh, it's done by the Embarcadero? Okay.
Yeah,
and we're going to have panels after the film with people from the film. Mm. I think we have Barbara Marks Hubbard one night, and Tiakasin Ghost Horse, who's a Lakota Indian activist from the East Coast, and John Perry Barlow, who does internet activism and so on. And we're also going to have a booth at Greenfest and do some panels and talks at Greenfest.
Oh, that's right. That's the Green Festival is this weekend.
Mm. Yeah, that was kind of what galvanized us to kind of premiere the film. We're kind of like, I mean, you may know that, like, the distribution model for film and media is changing a lot right now. So we're kind of like creating, you know, a model where we're first kind of like bringing it to the base of people that we think will really understand the ideas and be excited about it, and then hopefully can create a wider release later. So it's definitely very important for the success of the film that people turn out for these screenings, as, you know, then if they're well populated, then maybe the theater will, you know, will extend the run or even make it a national run.
Daniel, this is Rafe. I have a question for you. In your first book, you spoke a lot about psychedelics and shamanism. I'm curious, How does this tie into, shamanism preparing us for 2012?
As I talked about in both books, I think there's a lot of aspects of it. I mean, first of all, for me, going through a set of experiences convinced me that the modern kind of materialist paradigm was inaccurate, and that somehow that the psyche and the world are more interactive. This manifests through synchronicity, through vision, and even kind of magical episodes that shamans talk about. So I think in that regard, it's a fundamental shift in focus and in paradigm towards one that kind of encompasses kind of psychic dimensions of reality. And then also, I feel that psychedelics are, it can be very powerful to kind of, awaken people to, sort of seeing their world differently, to seeing a lot of things that they take for granted, whether it's money or cities or whatever. It's just one way that things could be constructed, and that actually, we could also, change things completely if we had the creative will to do so.
You mentioned something before that kind of struck my ear. You mentioned perhaps that humans suffer from a fear of actually experiencing their own magnificence. We can get in a rut of being really afraid that what would happen if I actually did have all that stuff that I dreamed of, or the things that I imagined that may come true, that are so just drop my jaw and steal my heart, that what happens if? And it's an amazing feeling, and I can also see how there's associated fear with that. What has that been something you're noticing?
Yeah, but I think that, I think it's true. I don't know, there's an adage that people are actually far, far more scared of succeeding than they are of failing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely some truth to that. Mm. And then on the other hand, people can be lazy, too. We don't want to, in some ways, we've created a false paradise for ourselves where if you're a middle-class person, you have access to all of these incredible comforts, it can make you very lazy, even if you're aware, on some level that it's not sustainable. 90% of the fish are not from the ocean. The glaciers around the world are melting. The seas are rising. The species extinction is accelerating. That somehow there's a disconnect between this false paradise of consumer goods that we find ourselves in, and what the planet can actually withstand and sustain. So I think people do have to be willing to, address that for themselves, and most people just aren't.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. The film is opening this weekend, the 9th through. I'm in baby land. I just had a baby. So.
9th through 11th, Friday 7, Saturday 7, Sunday at 7, at the Landmark Lumiere Theater, which we believe is near Embarcadero. And yep. Totally hope that people will join us there. I think it'll be really people. I think people are going to be really psyched about the film. The director, Joao, did an incredible job on it, I believe.
Daniel, this is Rafe again. I was struck when you were talking about shamanism, and I've studied a little bit with different indigenous cultures. What are some different practices that you've observed that indigenous people do, or that would maybe be applicable for modern-day culture in helping us deal with some of the changes and living a more sustainable life?
That's a big question. I guess there's a huge range of cultures that have a huge range of practices. Mm-hmm. But, I guess some of them are based on simply observation of the cycles of time and the cycles of nature. Mm-hmm. We've created a kind of this Gregorian calendar and this kind of 24-hour a day clock time. That's kind of a construct. Whereas a culture like the Maya, we're very carefully observant of more like these natural cycles, the equinoxes, the solstices, and the patterns of the movements of the stars and so on, and then honored those movements through ritual and ceremony. I think also, like, in terms of mental health and mental illness, you know, like, if you read a book like Black Elk Speaks, and he talks about all these visions he had as a child, somebody in our culture had those visions, they would probably be imprisoned for schizophrenia. But in his culture, the tribe actually recognized them as important and acted them out, you know, to give them validity and you know, sort of show them to the whole community.
Very interesting. You know, one thing that struck me some of the time I've spent with different shamans is just how connected they are with the earth and in the culture in general. And in our modern culture, we have such a disconnect. You know, we go to the store and buy food, but we don't really know where it comes from. We have very little connection. And for me, it's just, you know, having more of a connection of that we're part of nature. You know, we're not superior to it. And I'm wondering if that, if there's anything, any thoughts you have around that particular?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's like a direct quote from our film. That's something that Dennis McKenna says in the film. We're not the bosses of nature. We're part of nature. And that may be part of the lesson that we're about to be taught, you know, as things, you know, may go a bit haywire.
Right. I've thought quite a bit about when we do run out of oil, if we don't have a fuel to replace it, it's going to radically change everything, you know, including we will no longer have airplanes to fly to, you know, bring things to us. We'll have to live in a much more of a localized way of living and economy. And in some way, that may be positive, but it's also going to be a big shift for so many people. And
right. I mean, it's not like we run out of oil in 1 second. I mean, it's a decline of, you know, if we're in peak oil, which by a lot of accounts we are, then it's about I mean, it is significant. It'd be as much 8% decline per year. But that could still be over, like, 50 years. But, yeah, I mean, we definitely should be working, if that is the case. And if our, you know, government, you know, for instance, knows it and hasn't been telling us, that's a huge mistake, because really a massive amount of preparation should be going into, you know, alternative food growing techniques, you know, water harvesting techniques. I mean, a lot of things that are very simple for us now could become very, very time consuming very quickly.
Great. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Yeah. So just the listeners again, the film premieres tomorrow night. Is that correct? 7 o'clock?
Yeah, correct. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
2012, Time for Change is the .com is the website as well.
And also, if they can check, if people want to check out Reality Sandwich and Evolver.net, that would be awesome.
RealitySandwich.com. Okay.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Cool. Well, yeah, great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Enjoy San Francisco.
Thanks.
Welcome back to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. I'm your host, Dr. Rafe Eric Biggs, and we just listened to a fascinating interview with Daniel Pinchbeck in his film 2012, Time for Change. Just a correction, we realized that the theater, the Landmark Theater, is actually in California, not Embarcadero. So that'll be at 7 o'clock tomorrow. And now I want to introduce Stacey Haynes, who is a good friend and colleague of mine. Stacey is a national leader in the field of somatics, specializing in social leadership. She is the originator of Somatics and Trauma, teaching psychologists, social leaders, and practitioners to effectively work with individual and community impact of trauma and violence. In 2009, she's leading a national collaborative in innovating somatically informed social change model for progressive social movements. She's a senior teacher at Strozzi Institute and a master somatic coach. Stacey is also the author of the book Healing Sex and the DVD Healing Sex, both offering a mind-body approach to healing sexual trauma and developing vital intimate relationships. Welcome, Stacey.
Thanks, Eric. Nice to be here.
Yes. Wonderful. Well, why don't you share with the listeners a little bit more about your background and what is somatics from your point of view, and how does this relate with trauma?
Great. So I really spent my adult life fascinated by two questions. One is, how do people really transform And what I mean by that is not just change or get new ideas, but really transform so that what they're carrying around, like the burdens they're carrying around, have been lifted and they can take new actions mm-hmm. and have more choices. And then my other question has been, how do social systems change? And in some ways, that's an even more complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
But really, both of those pathways led me to somatics. And somatics is, you can think about it as a mind-body-spirit or a holistic approach to creating transformation or sustainable change. One of the questions that somatics asks, and we can talk a little bit about the neuroscience of it too if you want, but one of the questions that somatics asks is, what is it that you're practicing? And is what you're practicing aligned with what you most deeply care about and what you're committed to in the world? And somatics really looks at us as a compilation of embodied practices, kind of like we are what we practice. And so how do we transform that? Holistically, again, kind of at a mind, body, spirit, and emotional level.
Hmm. That's fascinating. And as far as your work with trauma, how does somatics play into an approach of working with trauma with people?
Yeah, great. So, you know, what is really exciting about what's happened in neuroscience really over the last 15 years, but is getting much more popularized today, is that neuroscience and really the field of kind of neuropsychiatry and the field of trauma are much more able to articulate now how the muscular system, the brain, the endocrine system, right, our whole system gets impacted by trauma. And somatics has been working with this really very actively for the last 40 years. Somatics has a longer history than that. But what we can look at with trauma is that when we're threatened, either in our physically we feel threatened or in our relationships or the people that we care about are threatened, there's an automatic set of reactions that happen. And these aren't controlled by our kind of thinking mind, but they're really run by the older parts of our brain and our bodies. And most people have heard kind of fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
And really with trauma, what gets kind of pulled out of the body or the psychobiology is protective responses that can look like fight or fleeing or freezing. Freezing mm-hmm. is a really popular one that we all use, or dissociating or appeasing. And these are normal responses. They're really healthy responses to try to help us either take care of safety or take care of connection. Now, how somatics understands trauma, and this is really neuroscience is agreeing now, is that those responses, they happen automatically, and then they get generalized. So a lot of people who've been through trauma, and let's say they're working on it, they can understand what happened to them, but the reactions that they're caught in don't change just by understanding. So someone might understand, well, that violence happened to me 10 years ago, but anytime they get kind of triggered or in a situation that feels scary, they go back into these very hypervigilant responses. That is because the part of us that understands or can make sense of things is a very different part of our body brain than the part of us that gets kind of mobilized into survival. What's great about somatics, because we work so much through the body and include the body, is we can go in and almost like unplug those survival reactions and process them through so the person isn't kind of trapped by that anymore.
Mm. I'm thinking about my own trauma that I've had with a spinal cord injury almost 6 years ago, and how my body has kind of reshaped itself from the trauma. And just sitting all day, there's a way in which my shoulders start to like kind of come forward, and anytime I feel kind of threatened, I can just feel my breath stop and my stomach tighten.
Yeah.
And it's just a good reminder for me, as we were talking earlier in one of our shows, about how important breath is.
Yeah.
And just coming back to your breath and breathing. And so often we forget to breathe because of our conditioning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You know, one of the ways we think about our conditioning is that, you know, a lot of times I think folks think about conditioning as psychological, like here's my psychological conditioning, or people might even go, there's social conditioning that we've all learned. And that's all really true. What somatics would add to that is that our conditioning literally becomes embodied, so that in some ways it's all we can do once it's become embodied. And there's some interesting research that's actually done with high-level athletes, and high-level athletes who are trying to change just some aspect of their game. And what they discovered is it takes 300 repetitions to just change a habit and make it consciously more controllable, but it takes 3,000 repetitions to actually transform the habit into a new habit. And you know, it's why kind of we're growing in our understanding of why it's so important to learn through the body or to include the body in transformation, because we can't really access what conditioning we've embodied without including the body, without including the nervous system and doing something differently with the muscles and including the psychology and the emotions. But you're right, very basic practices and basic somatic awareness techniques and tools are really a good foundation to start.
I'm curious if you had a client that just came back, let's say, from the war, from Iraq or Afghanistan, and they are have post-traumatic stress disorder, what would be some ways you would work with that person?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thanks for asking that. We're actually in conversation right now with a new program being developed through the Marines. You know, it's just, you know, not confirmed at this point, but there's a lot of programs going, God, how do we help the women and men coming back from live war zones? Now, there's plenty of trauma domestically as well, but it's good to focus this way. So one of the first things we do is really build a person's somatic awareness as to how their mind, body, spirit, or mind, mood, you know, emotions, and body are automatically reacting to normal everyday stimuli. So that might be, and this is really typical for post-traumatic stress disorder, it might be that there's a loud sound, and instead of that person processing it like, oh, that was a loud sound, the neighbor dropped their trash can or something like that, their whole body would go into a hypervigilant fight-flight-freeze response automatically. So the first thing we do is really build a lot of somatic awareness, like how does that happen in your body? Where do you get tight? What happens to your breath, just like what you said? Usually people start holding their breath. And then what impulse do you have? Do you want to run? Do you want to fight? Do you want to disappear? So we'd really build a lot of awareness of how those survivor reactions are just running them. Yeah, a lot of people try to numb all that out either with drugs, with just literally numbing and dissociating. Like people are trying to get away from all that discomfort, but what's important is they do the opposite. They kind of go toward it in order to heal it. So we do that first, build a lot of somatic awareness. And then another key part of somatics is really helping all of that, you know, what's a healthy, normal response to violence and a healthy, normal response to trauma, right? Help that work its way through the body. So one of the sets of techniques that we use in somatics is called somatic body work. And where the body is contracted, where the body has become numb or kind of void, we work with the body to really help soften and let go and let the experience out of the body. I know this sounds strange, but as the body opens and softens and we work with it somatically, it's almost like the stories that are held in the body get to come out and you get to complete the experience. So maybe an Afghanistan vet might have seen things that would be devastating for any of us to see, but never got the chance to have the real human response of fear or crying and grief or terror, all the things that go along with trauma, and we'd now make room to complete that experience and let that happen, and then the body doesn't have to hold on to that story anymore. So there's more that we do, but those would be some of the first steps. You know, eventually what we want to develop is kind of the embodied skills and the embodied capacity to live a really choiceful, centered life instead of a life that's reacting to trauma that happened in the past.
Excellent. And you spoke a lot about personal change and transformation. How does this translate into social change?
Yeah, that's a totally great question. Well, that's one of the main inquiries that we're in right now. Over the last maybe 7 years, Generation 5, which is a nonprofit committed to ending child sexual abuse within five generations, and I helped co-found that. But we've been using somatics to train community leaders and community organizers to work more effectively with an issue that's so traumatic. So we've been using it to do leadership development and, you know, developing community organizers and helping people really develop the emotional capacity to deal with an issue as kind of triggering and traumatic as child sexual abuse instead of just reacting to it. So that's been one of our places of exploration, is how do we use it to do leadership development based on social issues. Then, as you mentioned in the introduction, this last year, in 2009, through the beginning of this year, we gathered about 25 social movement leaders from across the country, brought them together for about 16 days, all told, and really looked at the core somatic principles and practices and looked at how does the somatic understanding of change, how change happens. Because somatics says it's not just information that transforms things, it's being able to kind of unpack our conditioning and then practice a whole new set of thinking, moods and emotions and actions that are aligned with what we care about, right? It's embodying the change, right? It's kind of be the change we seek. How do we use those principles and practices and apply it to wider scale change? So we explored a lot about how social movement organizations could use somatics to do their organizational development work. We talked about how somatics can inform a transformative organizing approach. And then looked at, like, what are default practices at the layer of community or the layer of society that we could shift to a different set of practices. So really, we're in the exploration of how do we scale that up to the level of systems change, but it's fundamentally using the principles and the practices of somatics to look at change differently. I can tell you more stories if you want.
Stacy, I know you also do work with the Strozzi Institute and work with leaders quite a bit.
Yeah.
And how would a leader, if a leader came to you and wanted to work on developing a stronger presence and way of leading, what would be some practices that you would share?
Great. One of the first things that we do is really help people get very, very clear about what they authentically care about. And it isn't just kind of like, here's what my nonprofit or my business tells me to say I care about. It's really what deeply moves someone. And we might ask that question of, you know, if near your death, you could turn around and say, I used my courage exactly in the places where I needed to. this lifetime. It's like that kind of like deep purpose. So we really help people access that, because that becomes really what we want to help someone embody and be able to act from. So we'd help them get access to them. And a lot of times we have thoughts about what we care about, but then it takes really dropping down into much more of the feeling self to know what we care about in our guts and in our hearts. Yeah. Then what we really do is we say, well, who do you need to be as a leader to consistently act from that commitment and that declaration? So, you know, we're all full of contradictions. So a lot of times we care about something and then we act in a way that's not aligned with that. And what we say really builds trust, what builds leadership presence, is that people can become the person who acts consistent with what they most care about. Now, there's a lot of practices that we would put someone in to do that. A very simple one is a centering practice, where we have people really center inside of their length and their dignity, their width, right? We use the body, so that's why I'm using dimensions, their width, which is also really connected to their ability to contact and be in community with other people, their depth, which gets them connected to both where they come from and where they're going, and then centering on their commitment and what they care about. And it's a body-based, again, a holistic approach to, sorry for the jargon, but to have people embody what they care about, not just leave it a good idea.
That's fantastic.
So, Stacey, this is Rob. How's it going today?
Hi, good, thanks.
Good. When I'm listening to you, and everything you have to say is awesome. I love it. And as you know, us in the West, we are so stuck in our heads.
Yep.
What is something that a layman, someone who's never heard of somatics ever, can do to just become a little bit more into their body and out of their head?
That's great. Very, very simple thing is drop from your thinking self. Like, most of us identify with our thinking self, like I am my thoughts or I am my neocortex, right? Drop from your thinking self down to your feeling self. And what I mean by that is practice regularly feeling the sensations that are happening in your body right now. And most of us just are completely unpracticed at that. So the sensations might be the various temperatures that you feel. It might be places where you feel more or less pressure. Or it might be a movement. You might feel your heartbeat or a twitch in your calf, right? So drop from your thinking self down to your feeling self. And that includes your mood. You can listen for your mood and your emotions. But then also treat your feeling self as if it was intelligent. A lot of what we learn to do in the West is go, I'm going to numb my feelings. I'm going to medicate my feelings. I'm going to ignore my feelings, because this is all about mind over matter. And, you know, we really inherited that worldview. It's a very rationalistic worldview. But inside of that, some of the most meaningful aspects of life, like connection, like interdependence, like purpose, we can't really get much access to unless we really drop into the feeling self as well. I just want to offer something, a way to interpret the body instead of like this mass of muscles that kind of carries our brain around. One way to think about the body is as 3 billion years of evolutionary wisdom. Or if we just want to come to like Homo sapiens, we can say it's 15,000 years of evolutionary wisdom. There's so much intelligence in the felt senses. And we don't want to throw out the thinking mind. We love the thinking mind, too, but there's so much information that we have learned to turn away from, and we want to turn back toward that.
So what you're saying is that we can draw upon all this wisdom that we have, and by using somatics, we can actually drop into that and use that when we're making decisions.
Decisions, when we're building relationships, mm-hmm. when we're setting our vision and our course of action, when we're raising our kids, all of the above. Yep.
So, Stacey, so often, like, I have these intuitions about what I should do. And how does intuition play into somatics?
That's totally a great question. One of the best ways I've heard intuition explained is that it's a sensation based and emotionally based and spiritually based way to gain information and to pay attention. So one of the ways that neuroscience is talking about the human body now, there's a scientist, Candace Pert, and she's kind of put forward this model, is that we actually have three brains. So one is the actual organ of the brain in our head, the other is the brain of the heart, and the other is the brain of our gut. And that perspective would say it's intuition is the brain of your gut speaking to you. And mostly it speaks to you through sensations or through images rather than through words, which is often how our minds think. But what I see is as people do somatic work, get more and more present to kind of all levels of their intelligence, that their capacity to access their intuition and let their intuition inform them becomes much greater. How do you feel your intuition?
Well, it's interesting. The other day I was driving to go visit a client, and it was like 5 o'clock, and there was just incredible traffic. And I was really tired, and I thought, I don't know if this is the best decision for me. And I was tuning to my intuition. And so I pulled off the freeway, and as I did, I got a message from my client. And he was saying that he had another appointment that he had to attend to, and he was hoping we could reschedule our appointment. So it's fascinating because my intuition told me exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And my brain was thinking, oh, I'll just power through the traffic. And mm-hmm. But then I tuned in, and it was amazing. Like, it was such a synchronistic point for me. And it was a good reminder. The more that I listen to my gut and in my heart, I tend to make even better decisions.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it also breaks us out again of a rationalistic paradigm that says the only information is observable physical information
mm-hmm.
or stuff we read out of books. We can really see through human history, even through studying animals, that we gather information from the field. Like there's light, there's sound, there's energetic impulses, and none of this is really woo-woo. Like, all of this is scientifically measurable, but we gather information from these multiple sources. And one of the things that I love when we're talking about all of this is that our skin is our largest organ, and our skin takes in more information than any other organ because it's what's interfacing with our environment. And it doesn't just take in temperatures, it literally takes in impressions and information that's kind of happening in the greater field. So maybe that's where you got your intuition from.
Stacy, we just had a listener call in, and she was asking if you would speak just for a moment on the relationship between somatics and what you do and people that experience family and sexual abuse.
Absolutely. Well, the book Healing Sex and the DVD that I put out are both about child sexual abuse, and many of the people talked about in the book and the healing process of the book really deals with family violence and intimate violence. Intimate trauma is very, very impactful. And especially when kids are abused inside of their family, because not only are they being hurt and violated, but they're being hurt and violated by the people who are supposed to care for them. And, kids know that they can't survive out of their family until a certain age. So it's like 3-year-olds and 7-year-olds aren't going to run away. So they have to make it work, right? So it's complicated how it shapes us and how it conditions us. In many ways, why I have stayed in the field of somatics for as long as I have is because how profoundly I see that it helps heal people who've been through intimate violence. So again, in some ways, like we talked about with the idea of a vet coming back from Afghanistan, one of the ways that somatics would really look at someone who's experienced intimate violence and work with them is to go, what are the ways that those experiences shaped you? And by shaping, we mean your identity, your emotional range, how you live inside your own body. And how did that conditioning help you survive? Because you survived. You know, I always look at people and I say, if they're here still, they are more powerful than what happened to them. Mm. They're more powerful than what happened to them, because not everyone makes it. And so we really go, how did that, how you got conditioned and how you shaped your mind, body, spirit really, really help you survive? And we want to very first honor that. And then really go through the process of opening back up a wider range of emotions, helping people learn to live back down in their own sensations again. And then, like we talked about with the vet, helping them complete the experiences that were really too much to process as a child. It's impossible for a child to process physical violence or sexual violence done to them by the people who care about them. Mm-hmm. They just totally have to go into survival. And then when you have more capacity as you're older, you can begin to process it and transform it. Yeah.
Right. Excellent. Stacy, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us and the listeners. If people want to get in touch with you, what is the best way?
They can go to my website and email me from there. It's somatics, and which is A-N-D, trauma.org, and email me directly there.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, we're just about out of time. My name is Dr. Ray Farrick Biggs, and I'm the founder of Soma Evolution. You can find us at Soma, S-O-M-A, evolution.org. And also want to mention that Daniel Pinchbeck, his film 2012, Time for Change, is playing at the Landmark Theater at California and Pine in San Francisco. So please come out this weekend, and it's going to be an incredible film. Very excited about it. So thank you very much, and tune in next week. We have Jay Kumar who will be taking over for Reality Sandwich. Okay, until then, be well.